From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders announced his second presidential bid this morning in down-home style on Vermont Public Radio. Later, he spoke on CBS This Morning about joining an already crowded field of Democrats backing the progressive causes he ran on.
Medicare for all, raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, making public colleges and universities tuition-free. All of those ideas, people say, oh, Bernie, they're so radical. People just won't accept those ideas. Well, you know what's happened in over 3 years? All of those ideas and many more are now part of the political mainstream.
Democratic strategist Simone Sanders, not related to Bernie, but tied at his hip when she was his press secretary in 2016, is here. And Simone, are you happy or worried? This is an older white man, as the midterms show Democrats are looking for young and diverse.
You know, look, I think it's great that Senator Sanders is in the race. I think the more folks, the better. I think a robust Democratic primary is what the Democratic Party needs. I am happy that the discourse in the, not just the Democratic Party, but frankly, America as a whole, is moving to accept and want things like universal health care, health care as a right. So will Senator Sanders potentially encounter some challenges with this current electorate? I think so. And it remains to be seen if he has learned key lessons from his 2016 race.
Let's talk about what some of those challenges might be. He had problems reaching out to African-Americans. Despite your efforts to make that happen, you are African-American. We're reading that Sanders' camp is doing a post-mortem on that, trying to fix it for 2020. He paid a visit to South Carolina last month, where the black vote went to Hillary Clinton. But then he also made his own State of the Union rebuttal as Stacey Abrams, the first black woman chosen to give a response, was making hers for the party. Your thoughts?
Look, I'm not currently advising Senator Sanders now, but if I was, I would tell him that he can't give fodder for the critics. And so giving the State of the Union response after Stacey Abrams, I just think invited unnecessary criticism.
Yeah.
Senator Sanders struggled to garner the support of African-American voters in 2016. I know now he's been to not only South Carolina, but Detroit, Mississippi, and a number of other places since then a number of times. The question becomes, though, in a field where there will be 15 to 20 candidates, will he be able to garner a substantial amount of support from a diverse part of the electorate to get the necessary delegate numbers?
Let's talk about the competition. The Hill ranked the Democratic candidates today. Sanders is third after Joe Biden, who hasn't declared, number two, and California Senator Kamala Harris, who has. She's number one. But polls generally put Sanders second behind Biden. And, you know, Bernie Sanders can brag he's much younger than Joe Biden a year. They're 77 and Biden 70. But yesterday in New Hampshire, Kamala Harris was asked if she'd have to run as a Democratic socialist to win New Hampshire like Bernie Sanders did. And she said, I'm not a Democratic socialist. Now, look, the word Democrat there distinguishes socialist from Marxist socialism. It's still a democracy with all that entails. But you know Republicans are having a field day with this. President Trump is calling Bernie Sanders crazy Bernie, blasting Democrats, all Democrats, as socialist, and getting this message out that that means that there won't be any private enterprise. This is what the Republicans are seizing on. Does Bernie Sanders have to be careful with that, as there are so many progressives now in the running that people might be afraid of the party?
Well, Robin, I think Senator Sanders has been a Democratic socialist for his entire political career, and I don't think he's going to switch it up.
But, does he have to better explain what that is? Does he have to better explain what it is?
Look, yeah. I think, honestly, and you know, I'm 29 years old. As a millennial, for a whole generation of younger people, socialism, quote unquote, does not have the negative connotation that it has for my parents' generation. So not to say that it's not a question that Senator Sanders and his 2020 campaign will have to answer, but I honestly don't think it has the bite that it had maybe 40, 50 years ago. What I think Senator Sanders will have to answer, though, is how his platform is different than the other Democratic, quote unquote, progressive contenders. There's not that much light and day between a number of these candidates. And so the difference between, you've seen Cory Booker out there on the campaign trail saying, let me tell you why I think you should vote for me specifically. And I think Senator Sanders will have to find a really good way to do that. Mm-hmm. And what I heard from his interview this morning and saying that, you know, he's not a woman, he's not a person of color, he's not this, I don't think that's the best way to do it.
Simone Sanders, the Democratic strategist and former press secretary for the Sanders 2016 campaign, no relation to Bernie Sanders. Simone, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, Chinese New Year comes to a close today. The nearly month-long celebrations conclude with a lantern festival, and you're hearing one right there from a province in eastern China. Right now, though, we are going to learn a bit more about the Chinese population here in the United States. And joining us now is Janelle Wong, professor of Asian American Studies at the University of Maryland, College Park. She's on Skype. Professor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So there are more than 2 million Chinese-born immigrants living in the U.S. They make up the second biggest source of immigrants after Mexico. Where are they in 2019? Where are they most concentrated?
Well, they're still most concentrated in the traditional gateway states of California and New York. About 50% of all Chinese are in those areas. But we also see that they are changing the demographic landscape of what we call new destination states. So they're growing very fast and even fastest in places like Nevada and Arizona and North Dakota.
Are there any places where they used to be in large numbers and aren't so much anymore that they've left?
Well, they used to be much more highly concentrated in urban areas, and now we're seeing rapid growth and significant growth in the suburban areas outside of major cities like Los Angeles or Houston.
Now, in a lot of cities, there are Chinatowns. Often there's like a gateway arch when you get into the Chinatown. But gentrification has changed a lot of that across this country. Are Chinatowns still the center of Chinese American activity or not?
They're really not. I think what we're seeing is a new kind of suburban Chinese enclave developing. And those are places where people don't necessarily both live and work, but where there might be a commercial or shopping area in Sugar Land, Texas, for instance, or here in D.C. in a suburb called Rockville. So we're really seeing a change in the traditional Chinatown that was really a place that was segregated by localities.
How well are Chinese people, when they come to the United States, assimilating?
So Chinese in the U.S. have really changed such that now most Chinese, the majority, are very different from past waves of immigration. They tend to be higher income, high wealth, and highly educated. And that means that they are actually some of the most integrated into residential areas, in different occupations. And so we're seeing a lot of integration.
How much discrimination do they face?
They face a lot of discrimination. It depends how you measure it. So in terms of residential racial segregation, they do not face as much as other groups. But in terms of microaggressions or assumptions about being, let's say, a forever foreigner, then we do see a lot of discrimination. 60% of adult Chinese are usually not going to be native U.S. speakers. And so we see some accent discrimination. We see a lot of assumptions about where people came from and where they belong.
And how often do they head back to China to visit, or what kind of ties do they keep with China?
We do see some what we call transnational circuits where people do visit China. They visit relatives. They might have businesses there. But we're not seeing the kind of dream of return that maybe characterized previous waves of Chinese immigrants. What we see is really Chinese getting more and more involved in U.S. social and political life.
Why do you think that is?
It's really about length of residence. So we've had a lot of growth since 2000, where we see the population doubling with each decade. And so we have a lot of long-term residents in the Chinese population now. They are not U.S. born, but they've been in the U.S. for 15 or 20 years, and they are becoming increasingly interested in politics and in community life.
And where do they tend to fall politically in the United States?
That's a really interesting question. So for the last three decades, we've seen the entire Asian American population really move to be strong backers of the Democrats, and Chinese are no different. In both 2016 and previous years, we've seen Chinese are more than twice as likely to support the Democratic presidential candidate. So we see pretty solid Democratic leanings. At the same time, Chinese are the Asian group that's most likely to say that they're nonpartisan. And we see a kind of growing conservative mobilization within the Chinese population, too. So it's quite varied.
What do Chinese Americans think of the Chinese political system right now? It's obviously very different than here in the U.S.
Yeah, I think there's also a lot of both criticism and loyalty. On the one hand, Chinese feel like they support and respect China's growth. But at the same time, I think they have settled in the U.S. and questioned some of the democratic shortcomings that they might see in China.
That's Professor Janelle Wong, who teaches Asian American Studies at the University of Maryland, College Park. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You may never have heard of Lee Miller. That happens to a lot of incredibly talented lovers of famous men. Born in 1907 in Poughkeepsie, New York, Lee Miller became a successful model for Vogue while in her teens. Soon after, up and moved to Paris, into the opium dens and jazz clubs of the surrealist scene, into the arms of the much older, famed photographer Man Ray, first his assistant, then muse, then lover, all along dulling the memory of a childhood rape with drugs and alcohol, while trying to sharpen her own passion for photography. After Man Ray and Lee Miller emotionally cannibalized each other, she launched her own career as a studio photographer, then an accredited war correspondent who was there when camps were liberated, took a bath in Hitler's tub, then later became a cordon bleu chef. All amazing, considering how much she drank to hold the darkness at bay. First-time author Whitney Sher tells Lee Miller's story in what the Boston Globe calls a dazzling seven-figure debut novel, an absolutely gorgeous and feminist novel about art, love, and ownership, a work of art in itself. The book is called The Age of Light, and Whitney Sher joins us in the studio. And we just want to set some ground rules here. You imagine whole storylines and conversations between Lee Miller and Man Ray.
Yes, right? I do.
But it's all pretty much based in truth. Lee Miller was raped by a family friend. She called uncle at the age of seven. She got a venereal disease. Her father did inappropriately take nude photos of her. She was a famous model. She was Man Ray's lover. She was a war correspondent in the thick of things and the front lines. All true.
Yeah, I started with all of the biographical details that I could learn about Lee, and I hewed to those as much as I could. And certainly, certain scenes are heavily fictionalized, but in all cases, I really felt like I wanted to stay true to who she was as a woman.
Did she really, in Paris, play a role in one of Jean Cocteau's films?
She did. She was in Blood of a Poet, which was one of his earliest films, and I believe is still taught in film school today, and you can find it on YouTube.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Well, you spent 2 years researching her.
I did.
Before you wrote this. As you peeled back this onion, were you as amazed as we are?
Absolutely. So I was initially drawn to her confidence and ambition. I just found her to be this incredibly modern woman who moved alone to Paris, and I thought it was just so fascinating that she did that. But as I learned about her, what I was most taken with was this fragility that was underneath the surface of her confidence that came from all of these traumas that she endured in childhood and all of the subsequent objectifications by men, her father, fashion photographers, Man Ray. And that, I think, is what makes her such a complex and interesting character.
And one of the wonderful things is when we get to the end of your book, you direct us to others about her nonfiction books, which we're going to run to. You mentioned Man Ray. He obviously, and all the men in her life, would say they loved her.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, what is true about their photography? And by the way, you have one of the most sensual scenes. I mean, this is going to replace the ghost scene where they make a pot together. This is when Man Ray brings his then assistant Lee Miller into this dark room to teach her how to develop film. And there they are in the dark. She feels man behind her, but cannot see him. His hand hovers over hers, heat radiating off his skin. I mean, it's just amazing.
Oh, thank you.
But she does become this photographer. We see she has talent, mm-hmm. and it's something she can control rather than being the object. But you also make the case that she discovered something called solarization. This is a technique that changes light tones into dark ones, reverses everything. When a mouse runs over her foot and she accidentally turns a light on, others have said they discovered it together.
Yeah, so this is a fascinating story and was, I mean, there was so much about Lee Miller that I found so intriguing, mm-hmm. but she tended to mythologized her life in later interviews. And so the scene that she describes in an interview, I think in 1976, the year before she died, and she talks about this exact thing happening. Is it true? I don't know. You know, it's a story she told, and I don't know if it's her just trying to kind of make a legend out of her past. But if that's the case, I find that interesting, too.
Well, but is it true that he might have taken some of her work and entered it, you know, as his own?
So they were constantly writing their names on prints that the other made, and both of them were quoted as saying, oh, it didn't matter who took the pictures. We were working so closely together in the darkroom that his work could have been my work and her work could have been his work. That's all well and good, except that Man Ray was the one who was getting most of the credit for that work, which I think is a little problematic.
Well, and you dive into that vein. I mean, did she express that she felt that she could not get out from behind his fame?
She did. She became more and more frustrated throughout their relationship, both by being eclipsed by him and also by his increasing jealousy. You know, he talked about how he wanted her to be young and free, and what he really wanted was for her to commit to being with him for the rest of her life, which she wasn't prepared to do.
Right. We know she has another relationship because it's alluded to throughout. Again, we direct you to biographies of her, but she was a war correspondent.
Yes.
And did team up with a life photographer, Dave Sherman, and did take a famous picture, took all of her clothes off when they got into Hitler's home after he died, and climbed into the bathtub and took a bath in Hitler's tub.
She did do that. Yeah. Isn't that incredible?
It is.
Can you imagine?
And also, when we think of the time this is in, she's one of the few female correspondents. There were others. Given that we know she's broken. We know this is, as a young woman, as a teenager, she's broken. We see the effect of the childhood trauma, the effect it's had on her. It's kind of amazing that she did anything that she did with that big a break.
Yeah, it's true. I think that the war was this final trauma that came on top of all of these other traumas that she'd experienced in her childhood and in Paris, too. And you know, after the war, she did try to continue doing photography for a while. She moved back to England and was still working as a correspondent for Vogue. But it kept getting harder and harder for her to do it. And eventually, she actually boxed up all of her negatives and photographs and literally hauled them up to her attic and never talked about them. Mm. So she had one child, her son, Anthony Penrose. He wasn't even aware that his mother was a photographer until practically the time of her death.
Really?
Yeah. She just never, ever spoke about it.
But
isn't that wild?
That's astonishing.
Yeah.
And in fact, when we meet her in your book towards the end.
Yeah.
We meet her as a frumpy kind of, she's a hot mess, living in the countryside, bottles stashed everywhere, trying to calm her nerves to have a dinner party. She does pull off an amazing 7-course meal, gourmet chef, but she's lost her looks. It's such a sad story.
It is a sad story, and I think she was such a creative person that once she gave up photography, you know, she then threw all of that creativity into cooking. But she was suffering from undiagnosed PTSD. She was an alcoholic. She was probably clinically depressed, and she was just a woman who she had had such ambition and such potential, and then you kind of see her life narrow at the end.
It does feel as if she does have something of a resurgence that she gets to see. There are shows of her work and his work together, and you write about them potentially meeting up decades after their affair. Do we know what's true about that?
Yeah. In real life, Lee Miller and Man Ray had this tempestuous relationship for about 3 years. They completely lost touch because their breakup was very painful and terrible for both of them. She moved to New York City and opened her own photography studio there, and then did a bunch of other things. She married an Egyptian man, moved to Egypt, all sorts of stuff. But right after World War II, she and Man Ray reconnected. They didn't see each other very often. By that point, he was living in Los Angeles. She was living in London. But they corresponded by letter, and Man Ray sent her gifts. And then at the end of their lives, there was a retrospective of Man Ray's work. And I believe Lee was asked to speak at that. In any case, she went there and met up with Man Ray. And there's this amazing story that I had wanted to include in my book, but it didn't end up fitting. But where they found each other at the exhibit. And apparently there was this giant cardboard storage tube lying on its side that I guess a sculpture had been sent in or something. And Man Ray, old, infirm, crawled in one end of it and shouted for Lee to crawl in the other end. And then they met in the middle. I just find that so beautiful.
Yeah. Comforting.
Yeah.
And how about as a woman yourself and an artist?
Yeah.
Writing your first book.
Yeah.
What kind of emotions did you go through reading about what happened to her?
I found myself at first feeling like Lee and I were not very similar, because she was this beautiful model who seemed to, you know, on the surface seemed to have this perfect life in many ways. And then as I got to know her and I realized actually it wasn't perfect, that she had experienced this trauma in her past, I haven't had that happen to me either. But as I was thinking about her so deeply over these years, what I did really connect to with her was her artistic journey. And as a woman writer, I have spent my whole life not feeling able to call myself a writer until now that I have this book coming out. And I think that that's something that women writers and artists experience all the time, that we don't feel like we sort of deserve to take the space to make our art. I'm not sure why that is, but I definitely felt that, and other women writers that I know feel it as well. And so I really connected with Lee very deeply in her desire to make space for her own work.
Yeah. Oh, it's a terrific book. The Age of Light, Whitney Shar. Congratulations and thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And we're going to have some links to photographs at herenow.org, one, an archive of Lee Miller's work and other pictures. We'll also have an excerpt of The Age of Light.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs, from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
The movie Green Book is up for 5 nominations at Sunday's Oscars. It's based on the true friendship between the famed African-American musician Don Shirley and his white driver, Tony Vallelonga, in the 1960s segregated South. There have been Shirley family members who say the story isn't entirely true. But one thing definitely is, the pair was assisted by the Negro Motorist Green Book, an actual travel guide first published in 1936, listing places in the U.S. that allowed black customers, hundreds in North Carolina, where there's now an effort to document them. Naomi Prilo of WUNC reports.
Live jazz music and conversations flow during Sunday brunch at the historic Magnolia House in Greensboro, North Carolina. Customer Evelyn Makemson looks at a new photo display hanging on a wall.
I'm going to find some of these places and see if they still exist. There's Martin Street. I know that's right around the corner.
The display highlights Magnolia House listing in the Negro Motorist Green Book. And Makemson won't have to search for other sites because the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission is documenting all the North Carolina sites listed in the book. The Green Book included barbershops, movie theaters, homes, gas stations, and hotels that welcomed blacks as customers during racial segregation in the U.S. The North Carolina Green Book Project is creating traveling exhibits and an online component that shows what sites are still standing. It will debut March of next year. Lisa Withers is a research historian for the project.
Being able to say, like, these spaces are important, they matter, I think is something that is really important through this project, in addition to the people who live there.
During the book's publication from 1936 to 1966, 327 North Carolina sites were listed. 14 businesses in Greensboro were listed in the Green Book. Only 3 are still standing, and one of them is the Magnolia House. Magnolia House opened its doors as a motel to African Americans in 1949. Guests like Ray Charles, James Brown, and Jackie Robinson all stayed there. In the 1970s, it closed its doors and fell into disrepair. Greensboro native Sam Pass bought the home in 1995. It took him roughly 14 years to restore it and reopen it as a brunch and event venue. Pass says back in the day, it was a special place for travelers who rested their heads there.
It meant that they were comfortable. They didn't have to worry about looking over their backs. They didn't have to worry about the offense of racism. They were home.
Pass remembers his own travels during segregation and how the Green Book helped.
I recall sleeping in the car. I recall going to Atlanta and having to stay at someone's house because there were no hotel facilities.
Research historian Lisa Withers wants to capture these kinds of memories. She and her team are traveling across the state to record the stories of people who traveled during segregation or remember the sites listed in the Green Book.
Without the human stories, a building is just a building. But I do think that it makes a difference when you start thinking about, oh, somebody was able to send their kids to college by having this drugstore here.
That's why it's so important to Evelyn Makemson to have brunch at the Magnolia House with her son every Sunday. She doesn't want to see another business that helps the black community close.
We're talking about black establishments. So I figured once we have one and I enjoy the food and the atmosphere and everything, I'm going to come and give my support to them.
And recording the stories and memories about these black establishments will help give a legacy to them and a new future for generations to come. For Here and Now, I'm Naomi Prilo in Greensboro.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
We're going to spend the next few days looking at a problem in this country and a number of solutions to it. The problem is homelessness. There are more than 500,000 people in this country who have been identified as homeless. Some of the solutions can be found in the four places we'll be hearing from, starting with New Orleans, where the homeless population more than doubled after Hurricane Katrina. In 2007, there were more than 11,600 homeless people in New Orleans. Since then, the city has reduced homelessness by 90%. Joining us now is Martha Cagle, Executive Director of Unity of Greater New Orleans. That's a nonprofit collaborative that provides housing and services to the homeless. Martha, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So 90%, that sounds pretty impressive. What has New Orleans done to have that kind of success?
So we faced, just an unprecedented explosion in homelessness. And we basically, relied on three major factors to really bring down homelessness. First, we assembled what I'd have to describe as a kick-ass outreach team that was willing to go anywhere and do anything to rescue and rehouse a homeless person. Secondly, we really put together a pot of rent assistance because the answer to homelessness is housing.
Right.
People tend to not understand that, but it really is about providing housing. And then the third thing is really about targeting that housing to the people who need it the most. And we take an approach which has been widely adopted around the country, but wasn't adopted at the time that we were first approaching this a decade ago, and that's called Housing First. And it's simply the idea that you accept people as they are, and you don't expect them to necessarily be clean and sober.
Mm-hmm.
You don't expect them to be able to take their psychiatric medication while they're out on the street, but you just accept them as they are, and you provide the housing first. Then once they're in their apartment, you immediately wrap all the services around them that they need to stay stable and live the highest quality life that they can live.
But where, how do you afford that? Because in order to provide housing first, you've got to have a house and you've got to have something that will pay for that.
Actually, this is a very cost-effective approach because when you think about it, it is costing the taxpayer a tremendous amount of money to leave people on the street because they're constantly cycling in and out of jail on charges that wouldn't even be relevant if they had an apartment. Things like urinating in public, drinking in public, obstructing the sidewalk because they're having to sleep on the sidewalk. Homeless offenses, in other words, that are costing the taxpayers a lot of money to be putting them in jail and processing them through the criminal justice system. Their health is deteriorating while they're out on the street. So they're being taken by ambulance to the emergency room mm-hmm. constantly. Those are huge charges, and really what you need is, a relatively small amount of money to pay for some rent assistance, and they can contribute some of that rent as well with disability benefits or if they're able to work with, employment income, and a little bit of case management assistance. It really has been proven over and over again in studies to be very cost effective.
And what's the long-term solution? How long do the people that you have helped end up staying in these, I would assume, temporary housing situations?
They're not temporary. This is permanent
this
housing.
Is permanent.
How long the rent assistance lasts depends on what people need. And we're kind of masters at trying to spread what is always an inadequate amount of money as far as it'll spread. So there are many people who do have serious mental health issues. Those folks may very well need rent assistance and case management for the rest of their lives. But others, particularly families, for example, the parent may be young and maybe lost her job and she's evicted and she ends up having to sleep in her car with her kids. That situation, we might provide rent assistance for a period of months. Then what we have found is that she's able to make it on her own after that. So we really individually triage people and give them what they need to stay stable and then assist the next person.
Another thing New Orleans has done is it's ended veteran homelessness, right?
Well, we have reached what we call functional zero, which means that we compiled a list using our outreach team, using our shelter lists that are updated every night, and we housed in their own apartments every veteran on that list except 9 that had refused housing, mostly because of mental illness. And we continued to work with those 9 at that point, have housed 4 more of them. And then going forward, we have made a commitment that anytime a veteran becomes newly homeless, we house them in an apartment within an average of 30 days or less. And we've maintained that now for over 4 years, and we're extremely proud of that. It is very hard work. It requires a lot of organizations working together, and the VA and the Housing Authority, everybody working together to make that happen. We've also reduced the length of time that any homeless family spends homeless to less than 45 days, and we're working on bringing that number down because the research shows that, you know, even the best-run shelter is no place for a kid to be.
What are the challenges that still remain in New Orleans, or what's the biggest challenge that you have at this point in trying to get that 90% to 100% of homelessness eliminated?
Well, we still have a relatively high proportion of our homeless people having to live outside, and you know, it's just something that we are constantly struggling with. It seems almost as if for every person that we house, that someone new is appearing. And that's because of this affordable housing crisis, the gentrification that we're facing. And so we just have to keep at it. We have to keep at it, and we have to ask government at all levels to do more to provide housing resources. We have to have housing for the elderly. We have to make sure that children aren't homeless. That's part of being a healthy community and a country that has a moral core.
I want to ask you one more thing, Martha Cagle, which is, what is the one thing that you've done that you, when you look at other cities or other places in the country that are dealing with homelessness that they haven't done, that you would say, this is the first thing you need to do?
I think at its core that tackling homelessness is really about knowing and loving your community. You have to love the people in your community and want your community to thrive and care very deeply about the vulnerable people in it, that you're willing to do whatever it takes. Whatever it takes is what you have to do. It's amazing how housing can almost instantly change a person. Mm-hmm. I can think of a woman, for example, who was very paranoid, schizophrenic. She was sleeping outside in the parking lot of a fast food restaurant for about 10 years and had refused assistance, which isn't actually the typical thing. Most homeless people want to be housed, but she was actually very difficult to help. And we finally had an apartment that we thought would appeal to her because it had an outdoor courtyard. And we showed her a picture of it, and she actually just got in the outreach van without speaking. She was ready to go. So that day, actually, we were dedicating this apartment building. This was a hot, hot day in late June in New Orleans. But no matter what time of year it was, she was always bundled up in a winter coat, heavy winter coat. Mm-hmm. And she refused to eat the reception food off the plate. Instead, she would pick up scraps of food that had been dropped that were on the concrete floor of the courtyard. Mm. I remember that very clearly, her doing that. Well, that was a Friday. And the following Tuesday, I went in the building and I didn't recognize her because she had gone with her case manager through this box of donated clothing. And when I saw her, she was wearing just a light cotton floral summer dress. And she looked happy. And I teared up.
Yeah.
You know, it was just such a dramatic thing. And she's been stably, happily housed ever since.
That is Martha Cagle, who is executive director of Unity of Greater New Orleans, trying to deal with homelessness there in New Orleans and get people into homes. Thank you so much for joining us, Martha.
Thank you.
We know that e-cigarettes, those little devices that deliver nicotine-laced vapor, often fruit-flavored, can help people quit smoking, but they can also entice young people in particular to start. And even if that doesn't happen, pediatricians say they're seeing teens with physical and mental health effects. A single pod of Juul, they say, can contain as much nicotine as an entire pack of cigarettes, and it's absorbed into the body more quickly. In December, Surgeon General Jerome Adams issued a rare advisory declaring e-cigarettes a youth epidemic. So what's a parent to do? Well, maybe test your kids. Lauren Middlebrooks is an assistant professor of pediatrics and emergency medicine with Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. Dr. Middlebrooks, welcome.
My pleasure.
Tell us how concerned you are there. We understand you've addressed this in a message to parents.
Yes, I have. So I'm concerned because at this point, the CDC is concerned and is now calling this an epidemic. In 2018, they did a national youth tobacco survey that showed a 78% increase in the use of e-cigarettes among high schoolers. So they're thinking that there are about 3 million high school students, one in every five teenagers using e-cigarettes now, and about 500,000 middle school children.
So you send out a message and talked about products that can check for nicotine and or cotinine. What is that, first of all? And how do these devices work? What is it that we're taking in?
Well, the main ingredient in vape pens, the addictive ingredient, is nicotine. And so that nicotine can break down into cotinine, which actually stays in the system a little bit longer than nicotine. So both of those, nicotine and cotinine, are things that can be tested in the blood, the urine, hair, and also the saliva.
And we understand a hair follicle actually might hold on to the nicotine for a lot longer, even 90 days?
Yes. So the testing for nicotine and cotinine can be broken down into qualitative tests, which is just a positive or negative, which are the more common type, and then a quantitative test, which is just the blood test, which shows the concentration of that in the bloodstream. The qualitative tests, which I'll focus on, are the negative or positives, and those are the ones that are more easily accessible. But the hair follicles can actually detect nicotine or cotinine in the system for up to 3 months. Mm-hmm. However, it is a longer turnaround time and it's very expensive.
You just mentioned the cost. Lab tests can run from $70 on up. Is this covered by insurance, the cost of these tests?
At this point, it does not seem to be covered by insurance. The one example of in a case where it may be covered is if someone is actively being treated at the hospital for a nicotine toxicity.
Well, so tell us more about what you recommend parents do. The follicle testing, is that only in the lab? I mean, you know, what kind of tests can a parent get to do at home?
The urine test, the saliva test, and even the hair follicle test are available online. The urine test typically are the most easily accessed and the most easy to use, and you get a quicker answer for a less amount of money. So the urine test can detect nicotine or cotinine in the system from 3 days to up to 3 weeks. So for urine, the tests range between anywhere between $15 to $25. So that's probably the most parent-friendly test that I would recommend. If you are interested in detecting nicotine or cotinine further out, then a saliva test would be another alternative. These could be a little bit more expensive, but can detect nicotine or cotinine for up to 4 weeks out after inhalation exposure. Yeah. And then the blood is not as easy to get because obviously you would need a phlebotomist or someone who could obtain blood from your child with an IV stick. That can detect levels from anywhere between 3 days to 10 days. That's the most accurate of all the tests, but it's also the most expensive, and it's also the one that requires a specialist.
Yeah. Look, this is a huge debate around vaping. There are school systems considering putting up security cameras in bathrooms, which is where kids tend to go to do it. How do you feel about those who might say, this is too invasive? Vaping is nowhere near the worst thing that a kid could do. How would you respond to that?
It's very important for parents, one, to understand the effect that vaping can have on their child, and then two, for them to explain that so that the child also understands the effect of vaping. Children and adolescents still have a developing brain, and the last thing to mature in the brain is the frontal lobe, which controls organizing, concentration, empathy, risk-taking, and there's some studies that have shown nicotine causing some cognitive processing delays, memory delays, and inattention. And there's also been studies that show it can cause depression and anxiety.
So what would you recommend to parents? How should they approach this? And do you have a choice between the kit that you can do this yourself with or the lab?
It would be wise to involve one's pediatrician in making that decision of whether or not to test your child and then what test exactly to use. The blood tests are very accurate, but they're very expensive. So it would be my recommendation to do a urine test because it's more cost effective and you get quicker results.
That's Lauren Middlebrooks, an assistant professor of pediatrics and emergency medicine with Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, one of the cities where there are now labs doing vape testing. Dr. Middlebrooks, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
So what do you think? Test kids for vaping. Weigh in, hearnow.org. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.